The following recording is Jeff Dyer reading two passages from Another Great Day at Sea, Life Aboard the USS George H.W. Bush, at Colours of Memory, an international conference on the writing of Jeff Dyer.
I was always self-conscious on the boat. Never felt like I was blending in. The crew members were too busy with their long shifts, their chow, and everything else that occupied their crowded days to pay me any mind. But I felt as though I stuck out like a hitchhiker's thumb. I kept circling back to Joan Didion's sly declaration of her advantages as a reporter in slouching towards Bethlehem, one of which was that she was, and I quote, so physically small that people forgot all about her. I, on the other hand, was probably the tallest, thinnest, and the oldest person on the boat. I was forever in the way, constantly saying sorry and excuse me, and generally gangling around the place, never more conspicuous than when I was attempting to lurk unseen on the edges of the gym, like Peter Crouch looming into the penalty box. There was a queue to get into the gym, and there wasn't a lot of space once you got in. It wasn't just that the room was small, there was also the small matter of every person in it being the size of two people. Arms were as big as legs, necks the size of waists, and so on. Three guys were running marathons on treadmills. The rest were inflating themselves with weights. They favoured baggy shorts and t-shirts or singlets to prove that however big they got, there was always room for further expansion. Even the guys who didn't look that big, well, they were plenty big too. The bald guys looked like their skulls were pumped. Inked and slinky, the mermaid on a bicep had become 6 months pregnant by the time a set of reps had been completed. I've always been intimidated by gyms. I've never been able to enjoy the towel round the shoulder confidence of somebody who knows he can bench press 250 pounds, or even knows what that means, or how much 250 pounds actually weighs. I just know that I don't like lifting heavy things, especially since I had this wrist injury, which stopped me playing tennis, which means that I've gone from being fit and thin-looking to just a feeble streak of unshouldered manhood, whose only saving grace is that he doesn't take up much space, who leaves plenty of room for others. I slunk in the corner of the gym like a whooped pup, wondering if a visible tat of a bulldog would have made me look more or less pathetic. The room was bursting with straining flesh and grimacing biceps. Breath came in fierce snorts. There was the clank of heavy metal being laid roughly to rest. I was conscious that I was staring at these Tom of Finland arms and chests with an intensity that might have been construed as homoerotic. There were a couple of women jacked into their iPods working out, but it was overwhelmingly male in there. Anthony Benning, the so-called fit boss, was standing next to me, wearing a t-shirt and biceps. He'd grown up in a military family, but was actually a civilian, supervising the exercise program on ship. From what I could see, his job resembled that of a bouncer, stopping people getting in. The gym was filled to capacity, so he was operating the one-in, one-out policy that you get at overcrowded nightclubs. I didn't know what to say, but feeling I ought to ask a question, said, how big can a human arm become before it stops being a limb and morphs into something else? Excuse me, he said. And so I changed my tune and came up with a different question, still physical but less meta. Oh, I said, are you the fittest person on the boat? I said. A lot of people fitter than me, he said. Huh, a lot of people fatter than me, I quipped back. Then, fearing that the conversation was taking on a slightly unhinged quality, I asked him about the food, its compatibility or otherwise with fitness and well-being. Most people eat healthier on the ship than they do at home, he said. This seemed stodgily plausible. I nodded in a way that I hoped would not seem tofu snooty. We stood without speaking, arms folded, his massively, mine meagerly, like spectators at a muscular orgy. "Don't suppose you know anyone I can score some steroids from, do you?" I said after a while. He smiled, shook his head, said he'd ask around. "Well, better make room for somebody else," I said, squeezing past him as though I'd just shattered the world bench press and reps record. So that's a little bit from early on, rather cleverly, if you don't mind my saying, linking it back in with that idea of the meta that cropped up early on. And then, I mean, it's really important to me. I really liked the way that, I can't remember now who was saying it, about that. You know, there is that classic English travel writing thing whereby, and you know, in whatever sort of way you're proving that you're superior to the people in the sort of host country. And you know, there's a sort of a lot of joking about what some of the people I meet are up to. But the great thing about this trip is that, you know, I met a lot of people who were incredible, and although the snapper, the photographer, had to leave, my time on the ship pretty well climax with this incredible day, what they called a steel beach party, a day when there were no flight operations. So the flight deck, which most of the time is absolutely out of bounds to everybody who doesn't have to be up on there because it's incredibly dangerous because you've got jets taking off and landing, it became the place for this incredible kind of barbecue, the whole of the flight deck. And it was just really one of the, well, as I say in the book, it really was one of the great days of my life. It was so wonderful. And at some point, everybody was in their shorts and T-shirts, even Captain Brian Luther and Nora Tyson, you know, the captain and the vice admiral of the whole fleet. They were there in their T-shirts. But there was this one guy I was introduced to, an African-American guy. He was dressed incredibly, incredibly smartly in a full sort of summer uniform with all his medal ribbons. And, you know, I said, "What?" And he was introduced to me, and he introduced himself. He said, I'm Clinton Stonewall III from Birmingham, Alabama." And it was just so, just the amount of history compressed into one single line like that. I mean, really, you could write a whole book just devoted to his name. And he was telling me about the medals, one of the medals he got, which was for saving the life of a civilian. And it was the most incredible kind of story. And then it turned out that later in the day, he was getting promoted. And because it was a no-fly day, he was getting promoted on the flight deck. So I'm just going to read you this this bit about his promotion that comes up later on. And I'm choosing to read this bit because this is my sort of thank you speech to Bianca and Joe, and it comes in effectively in quotation marks. The steel beach had become a flight deck in non-flight mode again by the time I went back up for Stonewall's ceremony. It was late afternoon, still light. Stonewall was standing in front of the island, being promoted from lieutenant to lieutenant commander. A couple dozen people were there to witness the ceremony. One of these was the captain, out of his shorts now and back in his flight suit. Stonewall's old ranking insignia were removed by two people and the new insignia secured by two others. Another ranking officer came up and read out the oath, which Stonewall III repeated line by line. They met each other's eyes. After this, Stonewall asked a friend to come up and say a prayer. When the prayer was over, people asked Stonewall to say some words. The sky was ablaze with holiday light. A strong breeze was blowing. He stood there, immense and proud. I want to say, obviously, I'm not going to embarrass myself by reading this in a kind of African American Alabama accent, but it would be better if I could. I want to say thanks to everybody for coming out, for finding time out of your busy day today. You see, I'm saying this to you. I know how incredibly busy your days are. I want to say thanks for finding time out of your busy day today. But this is not my day. It's your day. Look at what you did. Look at what you did. You put oak leaves on me, and I tell you now, I want to thank each and every one of you, especially those who kept me upright and squared away. Thank you so very much. You know, I was reading the other night. On October the 9th, 1901, a young man was born into the world. Name was Arleigh Burke, Admiral Arleigh Burke. He joined the Navy without a high school diploma. He had to drop out of high school and support his family because of the flu epidemic, but still he pursued his wish to join the Navy. He got a congressional appointment to get into the Navy, and the rest is history. I look at stuff like that. What if he'd said, "It is what it is"? A lot of people use those words as a token of giving up. What if he had said it? "Forget about it. I'll just give up and look after my family." If he'd said, "It is what it is," then a lot of things we do today would never have been able to happen. What if the Wright brothers had said, "It is what it is"? We wouldn't have aircraft carriers. We wouldn't have aircraft to launch off of these things. I wake up and I go to sleep with this conviction every night, not to let it be what it is. I want to change. I want to be that change. And I think I thank each and every one of you. You know, it's not an AV clip here. It's camaraderie. It's the pride that we instill each other, and that pride goes a long way. I've been doing it now for 21 years, and I tell you what, I thank each and every one of you. "Hey, I love that shirt there, by the way," he said, seeing the message stenciled on the yellow jersey of one of the guys in attendance. "No weapon formed against us shall prosper. No weapon formed against us shall prosper." The guy wearing the jersey then turned his back so that Stonewall could read out loud what was written on the back. "Believe that." Yeah, believe that. Because it's not business, ladies and gentlemen. It's personal. You know that. I didn't put out to sea with 5,000 business associates. I put out to sea with family members. And everything we do, whether it's up here on the flight deck, on the second deck or the seventh deck, I tell you right now, whether it's getting these catapults ready, serving in the meal line, whatever it is you're doing, it's all for me. You got my back, and I got yours. I tell you right now, Arlie Burke was also quoted as saying, "Loyalty up and loyalty down." If you expect loyalty from your subordinates, then you better show loyalty in return. Which means if you're a leader, then you better show loyalty. Which means if you're a leader out here, you need also to be a servant. The bottom's a reflection of the top. If you don't look good, I don't look good. I think Vidal Sassoon had it right when he came out with that. Stonewall had to pause here to let a wave of laughter die down. "And if I'm looking good here today," he said, "it's because of you. It's because of you." I look over at the statue of Big George down in the hangar deck. This guy's geared up in his flight suit. Don't know whether he's running to the battle or running away from the battle. But you know what? He's got a smile on his face. So be like good Big George. Have a smile on your face. I don't care what happens in your day. Keep running and do it with a smile on your face. So thank you very much. There was no noisy applause, but Stonewall was not quite finished. "How you feel?" he boomed out. "Good," boomed back the reply from everyone there. "How you feel?" "Good. How you feel?" "Good," we roared back. It was an understatement, to say the least. I felt so good, that I just wanted to stand there and sob. It was absolutely the most impressive speech that I'd ever heard. To have quoted Sassoon, Vidal, not Siegfried, was a touch of genius. I also liked the seditious bit of sculptural analysis that acknowledged that Big George might have been running away. And to end the whole Henry V of Agincourt bit of oratory with the injunction to keep a smile on one's face, well, that was a definitive rebuttal to the European objection that all that "have a nice day" stuff is just superficial. People were lining up to shake hands, to embrace Stonewall and pound him on the back. I shook his hand too, but I couldn't meet his eye because mine were full of tears. I thought back to what he'd said earlier during the Steel Beach party about having only one mother. What would his mother have thought if she'd heard and seen him just now? Or his daughter? Impossible to imagine more love and more pride than they would have felt today. How many moments are there in a man's life to rival that? I went back to my stateroom. What a day! The weather, the ocean, the view, the planes, the Steel Beach party, the Steel of Earl song, the line dancing, the captain in his shorts, the admiral in hers. Stonewall's promotion speech. It was one of the great days of my life, and I could hardly believe the luck and privilege of being part of it, even if only as an observer, an outsider. So, thank you very much for listening to me. How you feel?
Good.
Yeah.